Next up on the agenda is a fireside chat on emerging security threats between FTC Commissioner Rebecca Kelly Slaughter and security expert Joshua Corman. Rebecca Kelly Slaughter was sworn in as a Federal Trade Commissioner on May 2, 2018. Prior to joining the commission, she served as chief counsel to Senator Charles Schumer of New York, the Democratic leader, advising him on legal, competition, telecom, privacy, consumer protection, and intellectual property matters, among other things. Joshua Corman, the chief security officer at PTC, is probably best known as the co-founder of the I Am the Cavalry Security Organization. He has also served as the director of the Cyber Statecraft Initiative for the Atlantic Council, CTO for Sonatype, director of security intelligence for Akame, and in senior roles for the 451 Group and IBM Internet Security Systems. I'll turn it over now to Commissioner Slaughter and Joshua Corman.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Lisa.
We have a fire.
Yeah, we have our fire here, appropriately digital. And thanks, Josh, for being here. So let's start with a little bit on your background, and particularly, why don't you tell us a little bit about I Am the Cavalry?
Oh, sure. So the name is both wonderful and terrible, but I had been researching the rise of hacktivism and Anonymous, and I think many of us in the cybersecurity profession get into it because we want to be a protector. We want to do things that matter. And what I started getting tension on is we're so focused on what's right for our shareholders or our enterprise or our single organization that we forget that there's public trust, there's public safety, national security issues. And when I saw the rise of hacktivism and Anonymous, I started turning my eye towards the things that no one was paying attention to. And I kept naively thinking if I could build my credibility and get into the intelligence community or into Congress or White House and just get the right message to the right person, the right adult in the room, they'd go fix our problems. And we did that. We got in as high and deep as you can get. We brought five hackers into Fort Meade for 2 days with General Alexander. We had the conversations. And what we realized is the cavalry isn't coming. No one's going to save us. And that moment was both devastating and empowering, because if you know no one's gonna come, it really challenges you to say, what am I willing and able to do? So it took about 6 months later at DEF CON, the largest hacker conference in the world, we kind of did a plea to the hacker community and said, our dependence on connected technology is growing a lot faster than our ability to secure it, especially in areas affecting public safety and human life. So you can either scream in the darkness and keep being a pointing finger at past failure, or we could try something new. Let's lead with empathy, let's be ambassadors and translators, let's be a helping hand towards future success. And it was basically a call to arms that said, if you want to be part of the solution, if you want to try something new, if you want to work together, you personally say, I am the cavalry, and then donate your time or research to it. We just turned 5 years old. We've done significant outreach into Food and Drug Administration, into Congress, into White House, internationally. And we tried to be that voice of technical literacy, an ambassador and translator from all the knowledge in the private sector research community into safety critical industries.
So can you tell us, give us an example of what that would mean in practice?
So we had Jay Radcliffe, a diabetic who was hacking his own medical devices, insulin pumps. He was convinced the FDA didn't care, that people would have to die first, and you know, just didn't know how to connect that truth as a patient and as a researcher into policy reform. And we said, look, how about instead of just beating your head against the wall, let's try a different approach. Let's, you know, use our social skills. And so we built trust, we did engagement, we looked at this as a campaign versus a fixing a single flaw on a single device. And through that cross-education, we built deep trust with Dr. Suzanne Schwartz at FDA. They taught us how regulation works, we taught them how researchers do things and why. And fairly quickly, In the grand scheme of things, they started putting a lot more technical literacy into their pre-market approval. They then did the first safety communication in history on a bedside infusion pump that was vulnerable but unpatchable, which is a story we might get back to, and started just like really treasuring the value of coordinated vulnerability disclosure and started incentivizing medical device makers to do it. Are we done? No. But have we had material impact on turning up the cyber hygiene of the medical device cyber supply chain? Absolutely.
So I've been around Washington government policymakers for a while, and over the last 5 years that you described, I Am the Cavalry being up, and even for the time before that, one might say there's been a change. I think hacker used to be a dirty word in government circles. Do you think that that's still true?
I think it's absolutely changing. Hacker equals criminal for a while. Now, I just watched a testimony from Art Manion from CertCC in the Senate, and both the chairman and the ranking member both implicitly acknowledged the value of coordinated vulnerability disclosure and working with security researchers, and were giving a hard time to Intel for not doing, embracing it well enough, right? And it's not that it was a single day where the worm turned. What we tried to do, instead of just saying hacking is First Amendment protected free speech, or you know we don't like CFAA, we tried to show we can play a unique role in driving public safety in cars, medical devices, et cetera. And when we'd have that conversation towards the end, they would say, well, how can we help? And we said, well, for one thing, there's a chilling effect on researchers because of CFAA and DMCA. So we created a body of proof of the value we could demonstrate to public safety and national security in parallel with some great work from Katie Mazuris and Art Manion on standards and anti-rim attrition and the DMCA exceptions. But in general now, several parts of the US government have published disclosure programs. The FDA encourages and rewards having it in medical devices. I myself used a template that we designed with US Commerce Department and NTA. It's becoming something where not only is it acceptable to embrace hackers, it's actually encouraged.
Well, let me flip the other side of the coin. As much as government has been distrustful of hackers as criminals, I think the hacker community hasn't always seen government as their best friend or allies. Do you think that side is changing too?
It fluctuates. DEF CON turned 25 last summer, not this past one, but prior. We brought two sitting congressmen, Will Hurd of Texas and Jim Langevin of Rhode Island, to DEF CON on stage. And the reception was quite good. And yet there was still a backlash because, you know, of the arrest of Marcus on some of the past hacking things. So it's an ebb and flow of trust and distrust. The hacker community is not inherently a fan of government. They think government can only make things worse. And as such, the cavalry gets criticism quite a bit for, you know, engaging and reaching into these areas.
Let me pivot a little bit and sort of zoom out on the conversations that we're having here at the FTC and in the public generally. We throw around a lot of terms, privacy, security, safety. How do you think about each of those different terms, either together or separately?
Well, for anyone who's been watching the content over the last 2 days, it's still very difficult to even separate privacy from security. So adding a third thing of safety, or cyber safety as we've been calling it, is challenging. One of the ways I do this is indirectly. I tell my neighbor I love my privacy. I'd like to be alive to enjoy it. Because I think you can make, if you just want to solve for privacy, you can encrypt something. If you want to solve for privacy, safety, and security, you may design the system differently. You may have fewer things. You may have less attack surface. And if we ever sub-optimize for just one objective, we're going to be making trade-offs and robbing Peter to pay Paul. Now, some of these things will be zero-sum, but I think narrow solutions actually work counter to our collective interests. So when I think about they are partially overlapping Venn diagrams without drawing a picture. One of the ways I put this in healthcare was on the Congressional Task Force for Healthcare Cybersecurity, and they wanted us to focus on preserving HIPAA intent in the precision medicine era. And I talked to a whole bunch of chief medical officers. I said, you guys have more incentive to have a corpse with their privacy intact than invest in security that provides reliable, available patient care. And no one disagreed, right? So our incentives incentivize things. I hope they're incentivized the right things. And instead of having an encrypted database on a device, let's make sure it has less attack surface.
That is a chilling example to think about. And I want to use that chilling example to pivot to some other chilling examples of some large-scale attacks and breaches that we've heard about in the public. Can you talk about some examples of, you know, publicly known attacks and the lessons that you think we can draw from them?
Yeah, and these three won't surprise anyone, but maybe the talking points are slightly different. Chronologically, WannaCry is the one that scared me the most, but chronologically, Mirai is a real gut check for us, and I think I was thinking about it most of yesterday.
Let me back you up. Can you just, for people who aren't intimately familiar with the details, can you give an overview?
So there were three attacks. The Mirai botnet was mostly low-cost, $100-ish IoT internet-connected cameras that took down the internet for a day just before the last presidential election. The WannaCry attack happened on Mother's Day weekend two years ago now, I'm saying. And it took out 40% of the UK's healthcare delivery for a weekend. It had some isolated impact on the US. And NotPetya was a nation-state attack from Russia against Ukraine that escaped its blast radius and did significant damage to Maersk Global Shipping, about 20% of global shipping. Merck Pharmaceuticals had $870 million damage, including contributions to our national security supply of vaccines. This is designated US critical infrastructure. So that one attack of NotPetya did more damage than a hurricane. We now have single attacks with collateral damage exceeding those of a hurricane. So those three attacks, I think, should be policy game changers, but for slightly different reasons on each.
So tell us a little bit about why and whether you see any of them or all of them as preventable or should be preventable.
So in the case of Mirai, real quickly, these cameras had three defining characteristics. And they were internet reachable, they had a fixed hard-coded password, and they were unpatchable. So I said an unpatchable, you know, device is like the lawn darts of the internet. It's just inherently unsafe, in no world should that be okay. The collective might of those to be wrapped up in a botnet. I used to work at Akamai. That was the largest botnet we'd ever seen for denial of service attack. It was only using 20% of its population and only sending about 20% of the traffic. So a 20th of a 20th was still too big, took out the internet for a day. So one of the things I think there is interesting is those three characteristics I just described are most medical equipment. They're internet reachable, fixed passwords, or if you change them, you void your maintenance contract, and a lot of these are unpatchable. So those three things, I think they were scary to public policymakers, including myself, because prior to that, we had said if we simply add more transparency and information to enable free market choice, then a rationally self-interested actor will act in their own self-interest, the whole information asymmetry thing, we're gonna dampen that with more data, and then they'll buy the right things. The problem with this is the seller of that $100 camera is not incentivized to make it safer. The buyer of that camera is not incentivized to make it safer. It's the externalities in the tragedy of the commons where other people were hurt, and that other people might be a loss of revenue for Spotify or Netflix or Amazon. It could be a denial of service on several hospitals. So to me, that one scares us because it shows that if there isn't some minimum hygiene or, you know, seven deadly sins you cannot do and ride the internet, some minimum burden, irrespective of the size of your device or the size of your company, then the collective harm can shatter trust in public faith in these institutions, right? Institutional trust, as Kirsten said yesterday.
I want to put a pin in that thought about collective harm and just give you a chance to walk through the other two, WannaCry and NotPetya.
So in the case of WannaCry, what you had is a known vulnerability that Microsoft fixed. In fact, it was such a serious one, they fixed it in Windows XP. Now Windows XP is end of life, its successor Windows Vista is end of life, and its successor Windows 7 is now on extended support. So we are multiple generations old on this. I'm not gonna be Marie Antoinette and say, let them eat cake, get off XP. But they actually issued a patch for this in March. 2 months later, in May, an attack, a barely badly written ransomware, not targeting hospitals, did significant harm because most of the UK hospitals, most hospitals writ large, were exposed to that vulnerability to the naked internet.
Why, if there was a patch out there?
People don't patch, or people aren't incentivized to patch, or they don't have the resources to patch. And what we have is we've gotten drunk on the benefits of connectivity, but we haven't understood the responsibility that comes with that. You know, I had a lot of debates during the task force of, they said, well, we can't afford it. We don't have any money. And I flippantly said, if you can't afford to protect it, then you can't afford to connect it. Like, I might want to drive a tractor trailer. I might want to fly a 747. I might want to do open heart surgery. I am not qualified to do so. And if I want to, there's a burden I need to accomplish to demonstrate that I can do that safely. And what we've done is we like the benefits of the convergence of physical and digital, but we have not yet internalized the costs of doing so.
Okay, so let's stick on this for a second and talk about that small hospital with these devices or the operating systems that maybe aren't patched. When you say if you can't afford to protect it, you can't afford to connect it, does that mean we shouldn't have small hospitals? What does that mean?
And I intend to get to some practical advice here, but it's about, one of the core beliefs in the cavalry is that we are over-dependent on undependable things. And when you put it that way, you have two choices. You can depend less, which means a retreat, or you can make them more dependable, which takes will, money, time, political, public policy change, and is slower. So what we're really looking to do is right-size the risk and expose the true costs of these dependencies. Where it's acceptable, keep doing it. Where it's not, do something practical. So in the case of hospitals, it may not be that they can wholesale replace all their bedside infusion pumps, but it might be that when they buy the next tranche of them, they can buy one that's patchable. They can buy one that has a coordinated disclosure program. It may cost the same as one that doesn't. But what we're trying to do is nudge them from a prone state to a less prone state. If they're stuck with it for the next 5 years, it may mean disable the wireless capability and use it as a pump as it originally was intended instead of as a hyper-connected, hyper-exposed one. It could be compensating controls, but this nihilism that we can't do it perfectly, so let's not do it at all, we're absorbing significant and growing risk.
Okay, and let's just, the last one was NotPetya, so can you talk about that a little bit?
And NotPetya is really scary because that's, you know, a nation state level adversary. Russia attacked the MEDOX software, accounting software in Ukraine. It escaped its intended blast radius, and any businesses having a satellite office in Ukraine got hit. This included Maersk, which is global shipping, about 20%.
So go back again for the non-technophiles among us. When you say escaped its intended blast radius, how did that happen?
They were trying to attack Ukrainian companies. It happened to leak to the global footprint of Merck Pharmaceutical.
Because of internet?
A single office in, yeah, the entanglement of IT, right? So you drop a bomb in the real world, it hits the bomb target and maybe people in the vicinity of the blast radius. Mm-hmm. You drop a cyber bomb, a cyber munition, and it could ripple across the entire planet in ways that were not intended.
So then let's go back to this one. So Merck?
It hit Maersk, Merck, FedEx, a bunch of companies. One of the ones that no one talks about is Nuance, which is voice to text dictation, which is a near monopoly in hospitals for doctor notes and doctor orders. So doctor orders were lost or delayed, and we know that delayed and degraded patient care can affect outcomes for time-sensitive procedures. So that was a multi-week outage for a near monopoly in healthcare. So there was absolutely a calculable impact of that particular attack. And what I think that one shows us is how entangled IT systems are. So we talk about, well, even today, we talked about a small organization, a medium organization, a large organization, as if the size of the organization is the thing to focus on. Perhaps it's not the size of the organization or the size of the device, but maybe the size of the harm or potential for harm that matters most. And it could be this tiny little and unimportant, you know, accounting software mostly sold to one country can hit designated US critical infrastructure in the form of pharmaceutical manufacturing.
So how do we think about that? We have a lot of conversations, we've heard them here and in other places about what are the free market incentives, how do businesses balance the incentive for security and competing incentives that they have. What's your view about how that should be done?
I don't want to butcher Malcolm this morning, but he had a nice way of putting this. I think too much of the conversation is on what's right for my publicly traded company or my shareholders. Of course, that's one of our optimums. That's the private sector optimum. But when we talk about public-private partnerships, the reason we have a public sector, among many, is there are things that are not in the private interests, but are in the collective public interests, and that's where we need it. So I think he called it what's right for shareholders, what's right for customers, and what's right for, you know, society, greater society. I like the way Eli Sugarman says this at Hewlett Foundation. He says there are things in terms of the public-private partnership cliche we talk about. He says there are things the private sector, the public sector can't do, but the private sector won't do. And I think we forget there's a large and growing list of things that fall on the floor. And for that, he thinks that's the role of philanthropy and altruism. And I think that's one of the vacuums the cavalry's filled. Now, we don't want to own this. What we want to do is be the error handling routine that says, when it falls between the cracks of private local optimum and a public sector policy thing that we don't have the stomach for yet, or there's tensions, or we want to be methodical, how do we quickly triage and decide which things go where so that we can get moving?
So I want to come back to what the public sector should do. Let's focus a little bit in the constructive advice giving way first on, let's talk about the individual consumer. You're talking about some very large scale challenges across big industries and often businesses that don't have any direct consumer relationship or vulnerabilities that don't have any direct consumer relationship. So what should we as individuals be doing to help promote not only our own security, but the sort of global collective security?
So indirect answer, hackers tend not to like government. So I sometimes sound like I'm pro policy or pro-regulation. I think it's the worst possible idea except all others. In general, my philosophy on this, and I think it's a shared one, a growing one, is in general, free markets fix themselves when you have an informed buyer or demand meeting sufficient supply. Where it breaks down is really two things, and I think we have both here. One is information asymmetry, where I don't have enough information to act in my own self-interest. And to that end, some of the advice is the consumers don't yet know this, but we should start demanding more transparency, more information about security capabilities, primitives, or commitments, which I can enumerate. But in general, adding more information, like before we had Carfax, we knew that I might be sold a lemon. So we had lemon laws to dampen the effects of information asymmetry economically. So I've been pushing a lot for transparency, for labeling, for patching commitments.
How do we make that digestible and comprehensible to the individual consumer who may not understand what it means to have a hard-coded password or any of those other issues?
So some of it has to be abstracted. You and I might not know the difference between a three-star crash-rated car and a four-star, but we know a four-star is better. So there are ways to abstract this. That's part of the role of the private sector, the public policymakers.
Do you think that like third-party validators have a helpful role to play in that?
They could. We have to look for the right thing and the things that can maintain or preserve confidence. And to Sasha's point yesterday, a lot of our advice is really bad. So we don't want to be looking at prescriptive controls or, you know, are you updating your DAT files for AV every day? What we want to be looking for is, these are complex systems, so the failure is going to be frequent. Are you prepared for failure? One way the Cavalry did this is on our first birthday, we launched a five-star cyber safety framework. We did a similar thing called the Hippocratic Oath for Connected Medical Devices, and it's five postures towards failure. They have fancy names, but I'm gonna cut past those. We said, since all systems fail, these things will be hacked. How do you avoid failure? How do you take help avoiding failure without suing the helper? How do you capture, study, and learn from failure? Have a prompt and agile response to failure and contain and isolate failure? And this was really just saying, we're gonna have hacked cars. When they hack the stereo, can they shut off the brakes? So we've been encouraging things like have a disclosure program, be patchable, avoid some of the dirty sins like, you know, hard-coded passwords, things that are obviously bad every day, twice on Tuesdays. And we currently lack the political will to do that. So back to consumers, I think it's flippant to say consumers should do the following things because they really can't act in their own self-interest yet. But what they can start to do is start asking for or rewarding with their wallet people who are more transparent, who do have some of these primitives, who will say, we are patchable and we commit to patching for the next 3 years. When you go to buy your next home router right now, which one's safer? I'm not sure I could tell. Yeah. I'd like to be able to tell, and maybe slowly as we see more attacks, people whack with their wallets. But the other problem is, the tragedy of the commons is the other breakdown, which is even if I act in my own self-interest and buy the one that fits the purpose for me, I can still hurt others. And to that end, I think those are the minimum hygiene things we need some public policy on.
Well, that is a very good segue to the next question I wanted to ask, which is that these hearings generally are an opportunity for us to think critically about our own efforts here at the FTC and the legal landscape in which we are operating. I don't want to put you on the spot to say what the FTC should be doing differently under current law or what the laws need to change. So I will zoom out a little bit and say, in an ideal world, what would be the role of public policy? What would be the role of an agency like the FTC? Should we be setting out best practices? Should we make those legally enforceable? How should we be engaging with the hacker and security community? What burden should the government put on companies to sort of raise this bar? Generally, how do you think the world should look?
I'd like to give you a flippant answer. I have tremendous empathy for the role we're in and the point in history we're in. And there's a fine line here. I was thinking about this last night pretty hard. NTIA, Commerce Department, tried to come up with voluntary best practices for labeling for patchability. And we had a whole bunch of private sector engagement, and we came up with a label that said, you know, we commit, our product is patchable, and we commit to patching it for this many years. And towards the end, people said, there's no way in hell I'm signing up for that, because then the FTC is going to use it against me for fraudulent claims if I change my mind, if I find a library I can't update. So there's a bit of a catch-22 here, where we want to encourage more transparency for free market choice in parts of this overall approach, but not use it as a gotcha later for the also necessary law enforcement type enforcement end. To me, I've always looked at, as a layperson, my hope since I don't know your business and your value levers, but my hope was, it looks like you really have two major things you can do. One is, you've already done a few times, which is punish people for fraudulent claims. The TrendNet camera comes to mind, like, you can't say it's secure than not be secure. I think the response from private sector to that, though, is don't make any claims, which I think hurts my other goal of transparency and actionable information. So that's a fine line. The other one, though, I think is interesting if you want to play fast and loose with some of the experimentation, what would be bold. And if you don't, if you're passing known vulnerabilities onto your customer, if you're not equipping them with a software bill of materials that allows them to know any vulnerabilities in their product, if you're not patchable, these things may undermine someone's ability to defend themselves at all. So there's a shared responsibility between the producer of a goods and the operator owner of a good. And in a lot of these cases, those risks are being blindly passed on. So I always thought through the broad interpretation of consumer protection, there could be some minimum transparency or capabilities that are just considered, you know, negligent below a certain line, whether it's defined by FTC or simply enforced as a de facto standard. I'd like to see something where it's not about, did you pass a, you know, regulatory compliance thing with 116 controls, but are these things beyond the pale? Like, you were compromised because of a fixed unchangeable password, or you sold a device that was hackable but not patchable. Picture a different world where it's patchable, you supplied the patch but the operator didn't use it. That's on them, right? And I can see a world where we've properly placed the burden, the risk burden, on those in the best place to avoid risk. And that's gonna be a bit more about defining what those unforgivable sins are on the bottom end, the floor.
Well, I think we have just a couple more minutes, so I'm gonna offer you the opportunity to get in anything that is important to share that I didn't get to ask you about, but also articulate my view that I think this ongoing dialogue between the government and the folks in the best position to understand real security issues on the ground is going to be critical to our ability to address them.
The optimist in me says we're getting pretty close to critical mass. I'm not advocating for any one of these particular policy moves, but there's, if you squint, there's a few common things. There was a Senator Warner bipartisan bill on IoT hygiene. It said you must be patchable, you shouldn't have hard-coded passwords, you should have a disclosure program inviting researchers without suing them, you should use standards-based crypto, and you should be free of quote-unquote known vulnerabilities. Those are the avoidable harms, right? Elective risk, preventable harm. It got winnowed down to maybe three things: be patchable, don't have hard-coded passwords, and have a disclosure program. The UK government has a code of practice with 16 things, including those five. And the GCHQ said these shouldn't be voluntary. These should be purchasing requirements for the country. Out of nowhere, the state of California passed an IoT law saying it should have reasonable practices that are fit for purpose for the device, but the only one they called out is fixed credentials and passwords. So I think and hope we're getting close to some sort of minimum hygiene, because that little device that has a hard-coded password and can't be remediated can do significant harm, maybe to internet cats and maybe to hospitals. And I think if we aren't smart, you know, this is gonna be the asbestos of our time, right? You know, we put asbestos everywhere. It was cheap, fire retardant, you'd be an idiot not to use it. But then we look at mesothelioma and different cancers and the eventual unseen costs. And I think what we're gonna look at is we should only connect things we can afford to responsibly secure and connect, not just to the person making the device or the person consuming the device, but to these institutions, because to punctuate what we said yesterday, we have to preserve the confidence of the public, the institutional trust. And to tie this to my PTC role, I guess, in the last seconds here, one of the reasons I went from a cavalry public policy role into the private sector is I saw that this software was in medical devices and factories and high-speed rail and aviation. And I realized there's a shared responsibility here that even if I do everything right to secure my products, if my medical device makers don't take my patches, people get hurt. And even if they take them and apply these patches, if the hospital doesn't apply the patches, people get hurt. And there's a relay race where many of us have to change the way we do business, and none of us yet have internalized that. And if we're still having an argument about what's right for shareholders, we're not thinking about what's right for public safety, national security, and the true failure is any crisis of confidence in the public to trust these otherwise superior innovations and markets.
Well, that is both very important and very dead on the time that we have. So I really appreciate your thoughts you're sharing with them with us today. And I strongly encourage you, and I'm the cavalry, and your fellow hacktivists to continue that dialogue, because I think there are willing and eager ears in the government now, and having our part in that shared responsibility program is really important to me personally. So thank you very much.
Thank you.